Morning.
Morning.
So this morning, I'd like to talk about three Zen fools. Those of you who are familiar with the Zen tradition, you know that one of the unique features of our tradition is the honoring of fools. Starting in China with the Taoists. Then Putai, Hanshan, Shite in China, to name three. Then in Japan, Ikkyu, Hakuin, Isa, and Ryokan, who I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about Ryokan, and then I'm going to talk about my own teacher, Suzuki Roshi, who was known for foolishness on occasion. And then I'm going to talk about Harry, whom Susan already heard me talk about. So Ryokan, first Zen fool. Ryokan did his gambling and womanizing prior to the age of 16. He did it early, and he was considered a real fool because you're not supposed to do it until your later teens. But he got an early start. So at 16, he had done enough of that, and he was ready to shave his head and become a monk and go live in a monastery, which he did. And he lived in a monastery for several years, and then when he was in his early 20s, his teacher gave him Inca, that's what we call Dharma transmission. Actually, Inca is a certificate of enlightenment in some schools, not in our school, but in some schools. This was a Soto school, but that was, anyway, Soto and Rinzai sometimes merge. So anyway, he got that, he did that in his early 20s. But then by the time he was in his mid-20s, he was disillusioned and angry about the corrupt practices of the self-serving and greedy temple priests. Only interested in themselves, their own stature. How many people would come to their talks? how people would cater to them and support them in their wonderful dharma. And he detected something odoriferous about this, a strong, putrid odor. And he took off and left monastic life completely. We didn't leave the life because he kept it within him, but he left the monastery. And then he spent his whole life with no disciples, foolishly, after all his training, with no temple, foolishly, after all this training, as a penniless vagabond living up in the snow country. Foolishly, I presume. And some people wanted to honor him, although most people thought he was pretty out of it. But some people wanted to honor him. He was both a poet and imbued with the Dharma, but he refused to be labeled as a priest. People asked him, he said nothing, usually, if they asked him he was a priest. They found out, but he said nothing about it. And then as a poet, and he said, no, not a poet. Well, if you read his poetry, you see what kind of a non-poet he was, right? And here's one of his poems. Who says my poems are poems? These poems are not poems. When you can understand this, then we can begin to speak of poetry. He never published anything during his life. He did zazen all the time, foolishly. Walked around the countryside, foolishly. Played with kids all the time, foolishly. Never did a lick of work. Begged for his food, foolishly. You would think that that's part of the Zen tradition, but it's not part of the way Japanese do things. The Japanese expect people to work to earn their living. And monks beg. But he wasn't even a monk. He didn't beg as a monk. He was a monk who was a no-monk. Begged for all his food. read and read a lot of poetry, wrote a lot of poetry, did calligraphy, and on occasion drank wine from the pre-16-year-old days. And Ryokan dubbed himself Great Fool. Taigu gave himself that name, Great Fool. And his teacher wasn't too happy with him giving him that name, because the teacher had given him a Dharma name, you know. But what could he do? What can you do? Once you give someone Dharma transition, what can you do? Nothing, you know. His teacher said, Ryokan looks like a fool, but his way of life is an emancipated one. He lives on playing, liberating himself from every kind of fetter. So his teacher still loved him very much and thought he was very wonderful. Very wonderful. So what he did, Ryokan did in this period in Japan, was turn upside down the accepted social way of being. He just turned it upside down. He turned all the social norms topsy-turvy. That was part of his life and also part of his teaching. Part of his teaching. Respect of elders, Japanese very much respect of elders. He, for him, respect of youngers, the kids. Those are the ones he said, I respect the most. I hang out with the most. Respect of authority, and turned it around. The lowest people, the people who were not the priests, the vagabonds, the animals, the insects. And then he did two particularly unpriestly things. He really enjoyed playing marbles with prostitutes. Now, why prostitutes? I don't know. I'm just what I read. And he would play Go. Well, of course, priests were not allowed to come close to prostitutes because, you know, well, you know why, right? And then he loved playing Go. So anybody who would play Go with him, he would play Go. when he played with kids, sometimes they'd bury him in leaves, and he'd spend the whole day fussing around with them, forgetting even to go begging for his meals. There's one story about Ryokan playing hide-and-seek with kids, which he did. Which those of you who know Ryokan know the story already. So he was playing just before dark, hide and seek with kids, and he found a wonderful hay bale to hide under in a farmer's barn, and so he hid under that farmer's barn, and he was still there at dawn when the farmer's wife arrived to. Look after the cows, and she saw his feet peeking out underneath the hay. She said, Ryokan, what are you, in the world are you doing here? And he said, shh, the children will find me. And then he broke out into hilarious laughter. What a fool. Ryokan was absent-minded, unfortunately. Unfortunately, he was absent-minded. Unfortunately, he forgot his walking stick, didn't know where it was, didn't know when he'd last seen it. He forgot his begging bowls. He went through 32 begging bowls. I just made that up. He was always forgetting his begging bowls. His books, even his underwear, according to the commentator. I don't understand that part, but... He did. He lost his underwear. So, the famous scholar Kameda Bosai visited Ryokan once. here's what the commentator says. When Bosai found Ryokan sitting zazen on the porch of his hut, he waited. Ryokan knew he was there, supposedly. But maybe he didn't know he was there, because Bosai had to wait several hours for the monk to finish his zazen. And then Bosai and Ryokan happily talked poetry, philosophy, and writing until evening, when Ryokan rose to fetch them some sake from town. He still drank a little sake once in a while. Again, Bosai waited several hours, then grew concerned and began to walk toward the village. When he found his host 100 yards away, sitting under a pine tree, he exclaimed, "Ryokan, where have you been? I've been waiting for hours and was afraid something had happened to you." Ryokan looked up. "Oh, Bosai, you've just come in time. Look, isn't the moon wonderful tonight?" When Bosai asked about the sake, Ryokan replied, "Oh, yes, the sake. I forgot all about it." And he headed off to town. So the commentator says, to be distracted by life's moments is indeed a Zen virtue, though it is often a trial for friends. Oh, I don't know what you think about that. My wife doesn't call it a virtue. My children don't call it a virtue. My grandchildren don't call it a virtue. Even my cat doesn't call it a virtue. But here we go, here we go. just this. If you give yourself to this, before and after, all that agitation, all that cogitation about before and after become much less important. Doesn't matter what the this is or what the before and after is. And of course, we need to take care of before and after. But if you do a lot of zazen, sometimes you just get so absorbed in this that whether it's the moon or spending time with a friend or just being with the fans, you don't need anything more. You need nothing more. Nada. And that can permeate your daily life so you can be more at ease where you are. More at ease, right? Like, what's his name? I was pronouncing his name wrong last night, but Ben corrected me.
I think we both have it wrong.
Oh, do we? She too, she toe. Okay. So here's a here's some poems from him. Here's some of his poems. When I was young, I abandoned my father and ran off to other domains. I struggled hard to paint a tiger, but couldn't come up with a cat. If anyone asks about my realization, I'll say, just the same old Izo. That was his childhood name. And traditionally, you don't use your childhood name when you become a Buddhist priest because you move beyond all that. Your aspiration is to move beyond that limitless, that limitation. But for him, his childhood name was just A-OK. Just A-OK, just as he was. Another poem. All my life, too lazy to try to get ahead. I leave everything to the truth of heaven. In my sack, 3 measures of rice. By the stove, 1 bundle of sticks. Why ask who's got enlightenment? Who hasn't? What would I know about that dust, fame, and gain? Rainy nights here in my thatched hut, I stick out my 2 legs any old way I please. Any way, old way I please. So he lived giving himself to each activity, not worrying about gain and loss, not worrying about before and after. He didn't preach about it. He didn't talk about it. He lived it. And he was suspicious of people who talked about it. That's why he actually never gave any talks, never gave any lectures in his whole life. Interesting. Maybe I should just shut up. Another poem. What is this life of mine? Rambling on, I entrust myself to what is. Sometimes laughter, sometimes tears. So he shows us in his life and in his no poems how to just be with things that are changing. Be with things that are impermanent, which is everything. And just be with them and notice the suffering that we feel as they go. Because everything is going. Everything is going. And just be with that. Whatever the feeling is, just be with it. Another poem. Let me laugh when I feel like it. Let me shed tears when I am sad. Indeed, I am neither for the world nor against it. Another one. You know, they're all really short. Human beings are not metal or stone. As the seasons change, my heart can't help but respond. A solitary three-mat hut, a pitiful, worn-out old body. It's worse still now in the depths of winter. My suffering can't be described. Another one. How deeply I am concerned with the sorrows of the world, and as often am I quite at a loss what to do. If my arms draped in these black robes were only wide enough, how gladly I would shelter in them all the people of this floating world. Finally, when I think about the sadness of the people in this world, their sadness becomes mine. So he's showing us as Zen practitioners how to be close to our feeling, how to be close to other people's feeling, whether it be sadness about loss and change, whether it be physical suffering, whether it be the ripples on the lake, whether it be kids biking by, whatever it be, how to be close to what's happening. Without judging and commenting. Too much. A little judging and commenting is okay. But why do we have to overdo it so much? Gee. That makes me feel sad. Doesn't that make you feel sad that we overdo that so much? And if we're just with that sadness, not commenting on that sadness. I shouldn't be sad. I should get detached. I should do more samatha. Come back to the sadness. Come back to the pain in the body. Come back to the just being here in this delightful summer day. Come back. Come back wherever you are. Ollie, ollie, oxen free. Ollie, ollie, oxen free. Sure. Just as you are. As you are. So, I'm retiring soon from a job that I've had for 18 years. Retiring from on September 1, and I'm feeling sad. I'm very attached to it. I'm very attached to what I've been trying to do for 18 years, helping people with mental illness in the community. Very sad about it. And I can just be sad. People are always telling me, oh, because you're a Zen person, you'll be less sad. You think so? You think so? You can let these feelings penetrate you better if you're not cogitating about them. Just be with them, not making a federal case out of them. They're not. These feelings are wonderful. You don't need to make a federal case about any of these feelings. Just let them come in, let them do their thing. Cry when you cry, laugh when you laugh. You don't need to transcend anything. This is Zen. This is not most religion. Forget about transcending. That's what you're tripping out on improving. Improvement is to come back right here. That's the improvement. Whatever it is. Aches in all my joints from this disease. It's no disease. All my muscles. Wow. Means I'm alive. Give me something to pay attention to. I can suffer with you if I can suffer with myself. Right? If I piss and moan about myself, I don't suffer with you. But if I'm just there with myself, I'm here with you. Where's the difference? Where's the division? We're just fools. We're all fools. We are. Forget it. Forget it. So in life, ryokan was generally considered by most people a Zen failure, except for a few people, like his teacher. No, his teacher never considered him a failure. Never. And a couple of these scholars and these people who like to play go with him and the kids. But then after his life, decade after decade, century after century, now he's the most famous Zen master in Japan. What's the deal there? What's the deal there? The total failure became the one everybody admired. Kind of a little bit like St. Francis, if you know about St. Francis' early life. A little bit. A lot of similarities between the great mystics in the Western world and the great mystics in the Eastern world. Although they're not great mystics. I shouldn't even say that. Don't think about that. They're not great, and there's nothing mystical. We just use those terms. That's the first fool. Second fool is my teacher, Shinryu Crooked Cucumber Suzuki. Second fool. That I'm doing today. I mean, we could go on to, even though there are fools and fools and fools, because this is our tradition, right? Lucky. We're lucky. So I'll just give a few examples of his foolishness. And those of you who've been foolish to be hanging out with me over the last few years have probably heard these stories 3 or 4 times or 16 times already. But why not hear them again? So first one. When I was at Stanford as an undergraduate, my teacher came to speak at Stanford, and Suzuki Roshi, and he sat next to me in the front row, and I knew he was not happy about speaking. I don't know why he accepted, but it was bodhisattva, just be with your suffering. If somebody wants you to help them, you just do it. You just do it. You don't know. If you're scared, if you're trembling, you just do it. You don't cogitate. You don't cogitate. That's extra stuff. And if you see that cogitation, you just come back to this. Just got show to it. Come back to this. It's the nature of the mind to wander. So, okay. There it goes again. Olly-olly auction free. You got to call it back. That's what we did when we played hide and seek when we were kids. I don't know if people do that anymore. We called everybody home. Olly-olly auction free. We call ourselves back home. Back home. Anytime we... So anyway, giving a talk at Stanford and sitting next to me and turning to me just before he had to get up and saying, I scared, in a very soft voice. And then, grabbing my hand. He'd never touched me. I didn't think Zen teachers ever touch you except when they hit you. which they did in those days. I'm scared. And I breathed. I mean, well, what am I supposed to do? I'm his 21-year-old student, supposedly. He's the Zen master. I'm scared. And then he got up, gave a great talk. Being with just this means we don't have to prolong things. We don't have to agitate over them. Whatever it comes in, we're just with it. We're just with it. With our kind mind, our original mind, which is no mind at all. Kindly with it. And the next foolish thing he did, I have a 32 foolish things he did for Wanda's next book. I haven't told her lots of them yet. The next one, this is probably in the book, I think. The next one, so I'm So I'm at Stanford again. I leave Stanford and go back or something like that. Yeah, I do. I leave and go back. And we're starting, he wants me to start a Zen group there, so we start a Zen group. And nobody comes and for a while, and then I put a little ad in my little paper, newspaper, about Zen teacher coming. And that week, 10 people come. 10 people come to hear this Zen teacher. And so we do our Zazen, and then afterwards he gives a little talk. And you know, he talks about posture. He talks about how to hold your hands. He talks about how to hold your head. But he says nothing about your mind. He says nothing about how to deal with this, your mind. It's all over the place. So I say to him, well, I've set this up for him. I set it all up for him, so come on, behave. I got these guys here. I got mostly guys. Oh, no, a few women. Oh, yeah, from the article in the paper, actually a lot of women showed up. Anyway, that's irrelevant, isn't it? I said, can you tell him a little bit more about how to meditate? He said, no. And he said, Zazen is Zazen. And I thought, well, they don't even know what Zazen is. He said, yes, this. This. And I said, but I thought he didn't understand my English. Lots of times he didn't seem to understand my English. So I tried to rephrase it a different way. And he said, no. He said, it's not about what you're asking. Not about what I'm asking. I got these guys to come for you, and you're not even going to, you're just going to sit like, I mean, of course he was very friendly to them, but he would give them no technique, zero technique. And I sat there for like 6 or 7 minutes being pretty pissed and not knowing how to be just with my pissedness in those days. You know, if you're just with your pissedness, it's fine. Just be with it. You've got some warmth to it. It has some tightness in the muscles in your jaws. Just be with it. It's pretty cool. But I didn't know about that then. I didn't know about it. And so that was then we had did our thing. Well, we had to clean up the place. Well, you know that story. And then they all left. And I thought to myself, they're never coming back. And they never came back. The fool. They never came back. The fool. Zen fool, right? Third story about him. So one day I was walking on Bush Street in San Francisco toward the end of the day, and I passed him on the street. This is probably in the book, too. Wanda knows the book much better than me. Much better. And he had this bag with him. And I said, hi, Sensei, I guess. Hi, Sensei. And he said, hi, look. And he opened his bag, and he said, only a day old. And it was full of vegetables, which he'd gotten out of a dumpster at the grocery store. And I saw that there were little flies in that bag. And I thought it was yucky. And he thought it was wonderful. What a fool. What a fool. What a fool. And the last one. The last one is, when my teacher came to San Francisco, he thought he was coming to work with people like Miss Ransom. Raise your hand if you know Crooked Cucumber well enough to know who Miss Ransom was. Oh, three or four. He really thought he was going to be working with people like Miss Ransom. Miss Ransom was a British woman. He thought he didn't understand the difference between Americans and British, and he certainly didn't understand the difference between British and hippie beatnik Americans. So at first Miss Ransom had been his teacher in English, and then he'd been her teacher in Japanese, and she was a warm but controlled, proper English woman. where everything was in place, and you had tea at tea time, and everything was organized, and the emotions were all controlled, and everything was restrained and calm. So he thought that was what it was going to be like in San Francisco. He thought, oh, I would like to teach these people Zen. And what happened when he got to San Francisco? Well, it was the end of the beatnik and the beginning of the hippie, and you know. And so he foolishly had got it totally wrong about the group he was coming to minister to. And then he foolishly stayed and worked with us. He foolishly stayed. Even though, for him, we were very bizarre. Very bizarre. Well, he was kind of bizarre, too, for us. But see, we were attracted to the bizarreness. We had dissed our parents and our principals and our deans, and he was the man for us. He thought that was a little strange, because he was just a regular guy. But we thought he was the man, right? Not in that big, you know, just... He was our friend, and he straightened out our lives. And there would be no Soto Zen to speak of in the United States today if it weren't for my teacher Suzuki. I mean, he didn't know that during his life. His book came out and became famous when he had pretty bad cancer, and he died pretty soon. So that's his foolishness. That's the second fool. The third fool is a fool called Harry. Harry. And Harry doesn't know anything about Zen, but that's cool. That's even better, isn't it? Because then we get all too interested in Zen. You shouldn't get so interested in Zen. And you try to make it into something and try to be a special kind of person. Forget it! You're going to get nowhere doing this. You'll get somewhere, but that somewhere you get will be falling, will be not lasting very long. It'll be lasting this long, and then you'll get aches in all your muscles. But we won't talk about that too long. We just feel it. Oh boy. Oh boy. Harry. So, song by Johnny Mercer. See, I'm old, you guys. I'm old. Fools rush in where angels fear to tread. That's right. That's Suzuki Roshi. That's Ryoko. And that's Harry. Fools rush in where angels fear to tread. Because of the fear body, we don't allow ourselves just to be alive. Just to rush in to this. And participate fully in it. So Harry is the founder of this agency that I'm just retiring from, and Harry was a realtor in L.A. in 1969. He was a realtor. No, in 1968 he was a realtor in L.A. and he felt a calling to help people. You know, he just felt a calling. And so he gave up his realty, and he became a Presbyterian minister. And then he felt in his heart of hearts he wanted to help people who were disenfranchised, people who were out of it. So he got this opportunity to come to Minnesota from L.A. What a deal! Who would come to California from California to Minnesota? What kind of fool would come here from California? What? Huh? There's Harry. He heard that there was a rundown part of St. Paul called the Selby Dale neighborhood that really needed a minister. Church was in disrepair, and so he packed up his family and came out here. And then in 1969, he got this church in the Selby Dale. Those of you from Minnesota may know what Selby Dale used to be like. Pretty scary place, actually. Pretty scary. But not for Harry. I'm sure he had fear. But, you know, when we do things that we really care about, help people we really care about, extend ourselves, there's going to be fear. The question is, are we with it? We take care of it? Or do we freeze up so that we can't move into this big area that angels fear to tread in because angels are so good. We're moving beyond good to this. Beyond bad to this. Right? Right? We can do it. We can do it. I have no doubt about it. I have no doubt about it. So anyway, he saw these people wandering around the streets. And his term was they seemed like zombies. He didn't know anything about mental illness. He didn't know anything about chemical dependency. He didn't know anything about PTSD. These were basically homeless guys. Many of them were vets. They were suffering a lot from their PTSD, their depression, and they were using chemicals. But what did he know? He was foolish enough just to say to his wife, well, let's clean out the basement of the church. Let's put ashtrays in all parts of the basement, and let's have two coffee pots. And that was at the beginning of the agency that I've worked with for 18 years. Foolish, foolish, foolish. And he didn't even know anything. He had no background in psychology, didn't know anything, just knew these people were suffering. And saw that they smoked, and figured they'd like to drink coffee, and then did it. Gave his heart to it, did it. And then, foolish, he thought he could open a non-profit to help people like that, even though he didn't know anything. Went to other Presbyterian churches, and they thought he was a fool. They thought he was a fool. The biggest, fanciest Presbyterian church, what's the name of it in St. Paul? I can't remember. Said he was too foolish. They wouldn't do it with him. What's the name of that one? Hope. No. I don't know. Can't remember. He did it. He started it. And then, so when I came, that was in 1969, when I came 18 years ago, Harry became my inspiration. I was inspired by his foolishness. Inspired. It rubbed off on me. So that after he'd been there for a few years, we were able to open residential programs for people like the people he had seen wandering around the street. Residential programs to support both their mental illness and their chemical dependency without dissing them if they used, without kicking them out if they used. That was radical in Minnesota in 2001. Nobody was doing that. If you used, you got kicked out of any CD treatment program anywhere in the state. And then, tragedy after tragedy, including my brother's own suicide, but not only my brother's suicide, many, many suicides. Many, many suicides. People who had PTSD, depression, bipolar, anxiety. And Harry's foolishness, just like Suzuki Roshi's foolishness, just like Ryokan's foolishness, rubbed off on lots of people. It just rubs off, you guys. It just rubs off. So that my friend Diane had this foolish idea of opening a crisis residence for people in mental health crisis as an alternative to the hospitals. Because the last people want to do when they're in a real funk is to be locked up. Duh. So she wanted to follow the recommendations of a Blue Ribbon panel that thought the Twin Cities needed a crisis residence for people in mental health crisis. And the county attorneys in St. Paul all said, she's a fool. Don't support her in this because there will be suicide after suicide and lawsuit after lawsuit. That residence that she opened, now it's 20 years. That residence that we named after her after she died has served now 20,000 people in 20 years, 1,000 people. No suicides. There will be one sometime. There will be. People are suffering who come there. So there will be. But her foolishness worked. Foolishness works, you guys. It works. Works. So all of these, I could talk more, but I think I'm not going to talk much more. All of these fools show us how to collapse divisions. We're divided from each other. We're divided from ourselves. And through Zazen, we can come back to just this. Just this. That's all. We don't need to be all divided and arguing with the 32 different parts of our consciousness and all 32 different people. And if we do, we can just see it and come back to just this. So that we don't divide up the low and the high. We're just in our beginner's mind, which appreciates frogs just as much as it does lions. You know, in early Buddhism, it was the lions and the tigers. In Suzuki Roshi's Buddhism, it was the frogs. If you spent time in his office and looked at his altar, you saw little guys meditating, as I do in my altar, but he also had little frogs. And the guys and the frogs were all moving around. You go into office, sometimes the frog would be in front, sometimes the meditator would be in front, sometimes the... I want frog. Oh, Martin gave me a big frog, actually, when I talked. I've got a big frog, but I need little tiny frogs. They're better. So, we collapse these differentiations and come back to just this. We need these divisions to get along socially, but we get so fixated on them. Jeez. And then we miss all this wonder of the frogs jumping. Of the fleas. So here's Isa, the Zenfu Isa. I'm sorry my house is so small, but practice your jumping, Mr. Flea. High and low, smart and dumb, enlightened and deluded. Yeah. Okay, fine. Good social conventions. But do you think they're true? Do you really think they're true? So, one thing about all the Zen fools, even including Harry, is that they exhibited great laughter in unpredictable ways. Great laughter in unpredictable occasions. So, I remember this. And now it seems funny, although at the time it seemed annoying. You know how it is? When Suzuki opened his little brown bag and showed me to look in there, and I saw the vegetables, and then I kind of grimaced, he broke out into hysterical laughter. I don't know if it was at my grimacing or at... I don't know what it was. Hysterical laughter. When the farmer's wife found Ryokan that morning... hiding under the haystack, saw his little toes sticking out and found him. And he jumped up. He chortled away like he played a huge joke on her and the kids and everybody. Putai, who is one of the earlier Chinese, Putai Hote in Japanese, one of the earlier revered non-priest Chinese masters, his teaching was he carried a bag of oranges on his back. And then when kids or poor people or people who looked there hungry came by, he'd give them an orange. And when he ran out of oranges, he'd go beg for pennies so he could buy oranges. And if you see Putai, if you look at the old pictures of Putai, Putai is always has a huge grin. And a few of the pictures of Putai, it's nothing but his grin. It's one calligraphy stroke, and then sometimes two eyes, but not always the eyes. So, that great laughter comes when we let go of all the stuff we don't need, you guys. Which we can do at any moment. At all moments. It just comes. We feel joined. It's not sarcastic laughter. It's the feeling joined to everything. And it's the collapsing, letting go of all this stuff that we don't need. All this categorization, all this tension about the categorization. So interesting, in pre-Zen Buddhism, in a way, Zen turns pre-Zen Buddhism inside out in terms of attitude toward laughter and humor. So in pre-Zen Buddhism, there are six levels of humor. Six levels smiling and good humor. The highest level for the enlightened person is shitta. Shitta is a faint, almost imperceptible smile. You know, you've got your act together. That's what we want to get our act together, right? I mean, after 83 years, I should have my act together. I'm the teacher here, right? I shouldn't space out too much or cry too much, you know, get my act together so I can model for you guys how to get your act together, right? that's the highest one is the faint, almost imperceptible smile, like in the early Buddhism. Buddha had his little smile. Then you get down to the really bad stuff, and at the bottom, for the totally unenlightened person, there's belly laughter and rolling in the aisles. That's called ati-shitta. It's the opposite of shitta. So now I'm going to tell another Suzuki Roshi story. Why not? Oh, I've got a little bit of time. One more time. One more story. Okay. Okay. So, which is in my book. I'm sure this is in our book, right, Wanda?
I haven't a story yet.
So, my wife and I had my grandmother, who was my Catholic mentor, and I still dearly love her, over for dinner with Suzuki because she wanted to meet him. We had a little cat, a little kitten, and the little kitten saw this guy with his, I'm sure he didn't have robes, he must have had Hipparis type stuff on, but anyway, he had bloomers, you know. Well, the cat thought he was a trip and thought he was someone to bat at. With these bloomer things and this loose sleeve, so the cat started batting at him. And Suzuki started batting back at the cat. And pretty soon they were both batting each other. The cat was black and Suzuki was black, and you couldn't tell what was going on. My memory is, but probably my memory is exaggerated, you know. I've told this story so many times, is of them rolling on the floor together. You know? And then my grandmother just looking. Then the cat went away. Linda said, put the cat out. And then we had our dinner. And then for ever after that, till my grandmother died, she said to me, well, that was wonderful that you introduced me to your friend, dear, your meditation teacher. You said he was a priest, didn't you? And I said, yes, Grandma. And so every time she'd mention him, she said, he was a priest, wasn't he? Because she knew lots of priests. She hung out with, we had lots of priests come around when I was a kid. She brought more priests to my place than any place because we were the Unitarians and she was trying to do something. But, but you know. So anyway, that's our tradition, you guys. That's what we're doing. We're returning to our beginner's mind. We all have beginner's mind. We all have it. So that we can live with some immediacy. So that we can live with some naturalness. Just being who we are. Just with what is. Just with what is. So I'm going to finish by the description of the fool in tarot. Raise your hand if you've done tarot or know tarot cards. Uh-huh. Even some of the younger people. Tarot is a big part of the counterculture, you guys. Huge part. So here's Tarot. Here's what the Tarot's description of the fool. The fool, which is the best card to get in Tarot, and what would you expect, right? The fool represents the complete faith that life is good and worthy of trust. He reminds you to keep your faith and trust your natural responses. If you are facing a decision or a moment of doubt, the fool tells you to believe in your aspiration and follow it, no matter how crazy or foolish it may seem. So, A little bit of time for any questions or comments from anyone. Stacy.
Will that take the oranges to a wealthy person without discrimination?
Sure. Good point. If not, we'll show them how to do it. We'll remind them. Yes. Wealthy person needs oranges. Needs oranges. Yes. I was poor for my whole life, and then I inherited money. It's been harder since then. It's been harder for me since then. It's been harder for me and my wife and our relationship since then. The hardest thing in our relationship was in our 48 years has been my inheriting money. That's interesting, isn't it? So we need lots of oranges. Bring us oranges. Yeah. Stephanie.
Yes, Tim. Imagine the idea of a poor is something that you've known for a long time. It's been a tradition. And while the poor is intriguing, the poor also, there's a despicable side about the poor, don't you think? An irresponsible side.
Well, this is interesting. When I read this commentary on Ryokan, I thought, to be distracted by life's moments is indeed a Zen virtue, though it is often a trial for friends. I thought, that's a little bit. It's a little bit too much if our being in the moment means that we're not taking good care of before and after, not taking good care of friendships. Not taking good care of responsibilities. So I think that's actually maybe a legitimate critique of Ryokan and a legitimate critique of any of us who become a little too absorbed in each of our activities. I mean, we should be absorbed in planning, too. We need to plan. Planning is just as important. So it's a legitimate criticism of the fool in the narrow sense, but in the big sense, the fool plans when she plans, and that's great. That's no worse.
I agree, and I think there's only one word for fool, but there are different types of fools.
Well, that's right.
We need more words, I think, because there's a fool tradition. Even.
Yes, this is the great fool tradition. Mm-hmm. I mean that's Ryokan, the great fool, as a but then we get into all discrimination, you know. So that's the problem, right? Maha is great. He's the Maha, but as soon as we say we're the Maha, then there's someone else who's less than Maha that we don't want to hang out with. So yes and no, great, but not so great that it's any different. So great that it includes not great. But it's a good point. It's a good point. There's Beat Zen. I mean, when Suzuki came to San Francisco, Beat Zen was already going. Well, that was not the Zen that Suzuki taught for the most part, because Beat Zen didn't have regular zazen scheduled. It had a lot of focus on drugs and alcohol. Now, I don't mean to put down Beat Zen, but I'm just, you know. Good question, Stephanie. Five more minutes. Anything else? Wanda.
Just following up on Stephanie's remark. He wasn't a burden on society.
No, he wasn't a burden.
He contributed to.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. He made a great contribution. A great contribution. I mean, it is ironic that he's the most famous Zen person now in Japan. I think he's about the most famous, and yet during his life. But again, that's the way it was pretty much for St. Francis. Isn't that the case? I don't think that's too surprising.
He had a great sadness about how he felt he'd let down his family.
Yes.
Because he was the eldest.
Yes.
And
Yes.
He wept about that.
Yes.
He felt him a great deal of pain.
Even yes.
Even though he had to follow his foolish heart, he knew that it.
Yes.
That he let down his family.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
He felt terrible about it, but the story his family ended up just adoring him.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Errant nephew.
Yes, that's right. Oh, yes, the errant nephew. Yes, yes.